Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, the latest on health and healing, and also how you can prevent influenza by a simple herb. We've had a lot of discussion about the different diets, and one that's very popular right now is called the Paleo Diet. And a latest study from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine has just reviewed all the literature. I'll tell you all about the Paleo Diet in a few moments. Also, one of the nutrients that should be in everyone's diet every day is coenzyme Q10. One more good reason to use it. New study on that. Antioxidants prior to exercising, especially resistance exercise, improves training. And 10 ways to relieve allergies at this time of the year, plus more. Since this Earth Day, since our environment is upmost in some people's minds, from Rebecca Skolnit from The Guardian, call climate change what it is, violence. Social unrest and famine, superstorms and droughts, places, species, and human beings, none will be spared. Welcome to Occupy Earth. Then a special commentary from an investigative journalist, Wynne Stephenson from Common Dreams. Quote, "Screw Earth Day. Let this be this year's last." All right, what does he mean? He starts off with an angry screed. Let's see if it makes any sense. Then I'm asking you to call in and share your points of view. And later, if time permits, the rhetoric of violence from Chris Hedges from Truth Day. We have a lot to share today. Let's begin. I remember once I was asked to debate on the subject of herbs. And I didn't know which herb would be the topic of the debate. So I said, let me guess. Probably it's going to be ginseng, because ginseng at that point was rather popular. So I went to the American literature, and I found about 30 good studies. Then I went to the Japanese literature, not the Chinese literature, but Japanese literature, and I found 5,000 studies. Now, mind you, this is 5,000 quality studies published in highly respected journals. All that from Japan alone. Then I went to China and found double that. So when I went into the debate, the doctor I was debating with absolute with authority that only a physician on the debate circuit could hold gave forth the idea that ginseng, like all these other herbs, had no real science behind them. It was just old folklore, and it was a waste of money. Okay, then I started to show the two giant volumes, each over 9 inches thick, containing thousands and thousands of studies. So I remember saying, here's what we have. We have a debate between belief systems, not information. He has no information on his end. I have 15,000 studies on mine. He says it's only peer-reviewed literature. This is only peer-reviewed literature. He said from a respected institution, these are only respected institutions. So based upon a grading system, he would get a minus F if he were a student. And yet he teaches doctors. What does that mean is the bias now held in the belief system of so many doctors that there's nothing really good to say about herbs. That was back then, and that's been a while. But here is the latest to show you that the research continues. This is from Georgia State University. It is published in the International Journal of Molecular Medicine. Quote, ginseng can help treat and prevent influenza and respiratory viruses. A respiratory virus that infects the lungs and breathing passages. That's according to the latest study. And then it goes on to talk about the specific study here. Now, mind you, quote, there are no vaccines available for these respiratory viruses, which affect millions and is the leading cause of inflammatory bronchitis and pneumonia and viral death in infants and some elderly adults. So here is something natural, non-toxic, and studied that shows safety and efficacy. And yet, when did you hear this promoted? Not once, but the literature is there. This morning, walking into the studio, a gentleman stopped me on the street, and he said, I just want to let you know that I'm 45 years old. I've lost weight. My sense of smell has increased. My taste has increased because I went on a diet that got me off all gluten and dairy. I no longer have caffeine. I'm feeling phenomenal. And just want to thank you for at least making me aware that this stuff exists. I'm not sure whose diet he went on, he didn't say. But what's important is he saw a result. But for every person who stops him and say they saw a result like that, there's going to be five people who say, no, I went on the paleo diet, and which is the hot diet right now, and I didn't see anything. Here's the latest, as published in the International Journal of Exercise Sciences by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Quote, the paleo diet worsens cholesterol levels. Researchers put healthy adults on the paleo diet, including lean meat, fish, eggs, nuts, fruits, and vegetables, as well as a circuit training program. After 10 weeks, the LDL bad cholesterol increased, total cholesterol increased, triglycerides increased, and the worst outcomes were seen among the subgroup that had been the healthiest before starting the diet. So, here's the takeaway message. When actually put to the test, the most popular diet is probably the worst. So get over the myth about the paleo, how our great ancestors ate. That's one of the reasons they lived shorter lives. Nutrient of the day, coenzyme Q10. Why? This is from the National Research Center. It helps with the treatment of diabetes. That's type 2 insulin-resistant diabetes. So one more reason, if you are pre-diabetic or diabetic, to make sure you're getting between 1 to 500 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10. And also, before you exercise, understand that any exercise, biking, jogging, tennis, swimming, is going to increase oxidative stress. And that will cause free radicals, and that will help speed up the aging process. In this placebo-controlled study involving resistant training, that's weight training, they found that a single dose of antioxidant supplementation prior to a resistance training was associated with significantly greater cumulative power output during the strength training session and less plasma growth hormone concentration. Quote, this study demonstrates ingestion of antioxidant cocktail prior to a single bout of resistance training improved muscle contractile performance and modulated the growth hormone response following completion of the resistance exercise. So for the bodybuilders or those who are doing intense strength training, an antioxidant like vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, all beneficial before you exercise. If you want to turn off inflammation anywhere and everywhere in the body, from your brain to your eyes, from your muscles to your lungs and kidneys, curcuminoids. Now, curcuminoids are the bioactive compound of curcumin, which is the active ingredient in turmeric, which is the main ingredient in curry. Most people make the mistake of thinking if they eat more curry that they would get more health benefits. It's the turmeric's active component. That's what you want. You want to get curcumin. In this double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, they wanted to see what it would do to inflammatory conditions and solid tumors of people undergoing standard treatment. And they found a substantial improvement. Quote, from the University of Medical Sciences, curcuminoids suppress systemic inflammation and improve quality of life in patients with solid tumors. So, make sure that you're getting the bioavailable curcuminoid preparation. I'm suggesting between 5 and 8,000 milligrams. And finally, if you have allergies at this time of the year, what can you do to lessen them? Well, first, most people are not aware that carpets are breeding grounds for bacteria and dust mites and all other forms of microorganisms and danders. So wherever possible, remove your carpets. Hardwood floors, ceramic floors, slate floors, all good. Carpet floors, if you keep the carpets really clean, that means shampoo them with a non-allergenic shampoo. Rinse them after shampooing, and then don't wear shoes inside. Then you can keep them clean. But there are other things you can do. There are certain herbs and supplements that have been shown to help with allergies of any kind. Spirulina, the herb eyebright, and golden seal. They all can relieve sinus inflammation and general allergies. The pithy part of a pineapple, the core of a pineapple, which most people don't eat, but you can certainly blend it or juice it, that contains a very strong anti-inflammatory agent. It is called bromelain, brome, B-R-O-M, elain, E-L-A-I-N. That's an enzyme, and it can turn off inflammation, especially in your sinus cavities. Also, you could use honey. Manuka honey can reduce allergies. Most people are not aware of that, but it works. And then a steam bath. Breathing in steam is a very simple way of opening your air passages, and that helps. And if you put essential oils like eucalyptus oil in the water to create a powerful bond between the steam and the oils, that helps also with upper respiratory tract and nose and sinuses. Then what is called a saline spray. It's very simple. A saline is a salt solution. You could use Himalayan sea salt for this. And you simply take this, warm it up, and then you can put a towel over your head and fill the sink and just breathe this in. And that'll do the job. Or you can spray it in your nostrils. That'll also do the job. And then what is called a netai pot, N-E-T-I. Some people have used it. Most people have not. You simply get warm distilled water and you flush out the nasal with a little bit of saline solution in it. That'll loosen up your mucus and that'll help the sinuses drain. Also, mustard, like wasabi, cayenne, garlic, horseradish, those all, when you eat them, you notice your nose starts to run. That's the active ingredient, the isothiocyanates, and the allyl thiosulfonate. And these are ingredients that help decongest. Green tea also helps when you drink it. And then really clean everything. Now, when I say clean everything, I mean do it the right way. Get up on the ladder and clean the windows and the window, the shades. and clean behind the curtains, on the floor, under the bed. Get the dust up. Get the danders up. And then wash your clothes without bleach. Use a biodegradable and green shampoo for, you know, cleaner. Also, you should be bathing your pet once a week. Again, in a mild, natural and organic shampoo. And then take a little bit of coconut oil, not much, and massage it into your hands. And then massage your pet from top to bottom. And that helps protect their skin, prevents danders from drying and flaking into the air. Those are the things we can do that can make a difference. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about edible flowers that you can grow and consume, and what will happen if you drink 3 cups of black tea a day. Well, something good for you, but I'll save that for tomorrow. 2 comments today, because it's Earth Day, and because I was around at the beginning, and in fact, I published my first environmental book, Clear, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for a New Environment, way back, and was traveling around the United States promoting Earth Day. And when I look back, I have to ask myself, what has it come to? If you go on my website under photographs, you'll see that there's this huge thousands of people get-together. I was the keynote speaker for an Earth Day celebration. And as I'm walking around the fairgrounds where all this was happening, I'm noticing, A, that there were no organic vendors. It was, you know, fried chicken, barbecued ribs, hamburgers, hot dogs, french fries, beer cans everywhere. Secondly, the entire environment was strewn with debris. And I'm thinking of all places to forget about just basic civility of keeping your environment clean. Why would you choose Earth Day to be so disrespectful? So when I got up there, I didn't talk about what I was supposed to. I talked about, take a look around you. How many of you are smoking and drinking and littering the environment? What was the purpose of this day? And there was just total silence. Like, they didn't want to hear this. And then later, for Earth Day and then over at the UN, That is a video worth watching. Why? Because I didn't know what I was going to say. I had no idea. All I knew was that the room was packed with environmental organization leaders. So I got up to talk, but I'd been listening to all that had been going on in discussion prior to them. And I started off by asking, have we really made a difference, those of us who care about the environment? Is it possible to reform any institution in the United States? Many people put their efforts into what they think is a legitimate form of reform. If something's not working, okay, get together some people, put together some ideas, and surely sooner or later it'll reform itself. And I said, the trouble is, I'm not aware of any institution that will reform itself. What they do is, to maintain their power, they will pretend to put through some reform, like the McCain the election reform. It did nothing at all. The reform of Wall Street with the Dodd-Frank Amendment, it did nothing whatsoever to stop corruption of the banks on Wall Street. So when you look at all of these so-called reform measures, they do nothing, because people in power are not going to surrender their power nor be held accountable to it, nor step aside if their decisions were so egregious. You didn't see all the top people in the armed forces, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You didn't see the President of the United States or his cabinet. You didn't see the Council of Economic Advisors and the Council of Legal Advisors. You didn't see the top editors and publishers, the New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, Los Angeles Papers, San Francisco. None of these people apologized and recused themselves from public life and went to live in a monastery where they belong. No one showed that they were complicit in what has now been $6 trillion, and the death of more than 1 million innocent people, the displacement of over 5 million people, the destruction of the environment. So we learn absolutely nothing. So I'm saying, how many people in here are making over $100,000 a year or much higher, who have very comfortable jobs, by collecting money, including from polluters, in order to pretend that you're really interested in the environment when it's really just the survival of your own foundation, your job, you know, the $300 lunches or however you choose to spend the money. But at the end of the day, nothing is being done to fundamentally change the environment. But maybe I'm wrong. Let's just take a look. And I went through about 15 things that no one had dealt with. And then I gave some specifics about how one of the people there, major foundations, the largest environmental foundation in the world, made over $500 million that year, took $25 million from one polluting agency, one polluter corporation, but then no longer did you hear him talking about gas hydrofracking. Not a word. And then you see where their money comes from, and it came also from the gas industry. So I said, so what is the purpose of all this? I said, I'm not coming to any more of these events. I think it's enough. Anyhow, you can see that for yourself. What was surprising is at the end of it, I was actually expecting to be booed down or something somewhere in there, but there was just total silence, as if people were maybe having a moment of introspection. And at the end, the camera swings around, and you see that people applauded, standing ovation. At this older gentleman, who I didn't know that he was a second in command of the UN, he came over to me, and he said, "No one ever gets up here and tells the truth at the UN, ever." And I said, "I'm aware of that." He said, "You made a big risk today." I said, "Well, yeah." And I have this to ask you. Have you ever known any reward that didn't come with a risk? If the reward is that we push people into a conscious state that they wouldn't have gotten into, that stay in these self-delusions, then I would rather take the risk and be booed or rejected or vilified than to stay silent when I know the truth. And that's why I haven't been back. This is from Rebecca Solnick. Quote, "Will our age of climate change also be an era of civil and international conflict? If you're poor, the only way you're likely to injure someone is in the old way, by hands, knife, or club, and maybe modern hand-on violence by gun or by car. But if you're tremendously wealthy, you can practice industrial-scale violence without any manual labor on your own part. You can, say, build a sweatshop factory that will collapse in Bangladesh and kill more people than any hands-on mass murder ever did. Or you can calculate risk and benefit after putting poisons or unsafe machines into the world as manufacturers do every day. If you're the leader of a country, you can declare war and kill by the hundreds of thousands or millions. And the nuclear superpowers, U.S. and Russia, still hold the option of destroying quite a lot of life on Earth. So do the carbon barons." Yes, they do. But when we talk about violence, we almost always talk about violence from below, never from above. Or so I thought when I received a press release last week from a climate group announcing, quote, "Scientists say there is a direct link between changing climate and an increase in violence." What the scientists actually said in a not-so-newsworthy article in Nature 2.5 years ago is that there is a higher conflict in the tropics in El Nino years, and that perhaps this will scale up to make our age of climate change also an era of civil and international conflict. The message is that ordinary people will behave badly in an era of intensified climate change. Now, all this makes sense unless you go back to the premise and note that climate change is itself violence, extreme, horrific, long-term, widespread violence. Climate change is anthropogenic, caused by human beings, some much more than others. We know the consequences of that change, the acidification of oceans and the decline of many species in them, the slow disappearance of island nations such as the Maldives, increased flooding, drought, crop failure leading to food price increases and famine, increasing turbulent weather. Yes, heat waves that kill elderly by the tens of thousands. Climate change is violence. So if we want to talk about violence and climate change, and we're talking about it after last week's horrifying report from the world's top climate scientists, then let's talk about climate change as violence, rather than worrying about whether ordinary human beings will react turbulently to the destruction of the very means of their survival. Let's worry about that destruction and their survival. Of course, water failure, crop failure, flooding, and more will lead to mass migration and climate refugees. They already have, and this will lead to conflict. Those conflicts are being set in motion now. You can regard the Arab Spring in part as a climate conflict. The increase in wheat prices was one of the triggers for that series of revolts that changed the face of northernmost Africa and the Middle East. On the other hand, you can say, how nice if those people had not been hungry in the first place. On the other, you can say, not say, how great is it those people stood up and against being deprived of subsistence and hope. And then you have to look at the systems that created that hunger, the enormous economic inequalities in places such as Egypt, and the brutality used to keep down the people at the lower levels of the social system, as well as the weather. People revolt when their lives are unbearable. Sometimes, materially, it works. It creates that unbearableness. Droughts, plagues, storms, floods. But food and medical care, health and well-being, access to housing and education, these things are also governed by economic means and government policy. That's what the revolt called Occupy Wall Street was against. Climate change will increase hunger as food prices rise and food production falters. But we already have widespread hunger on Earth, and much of it is due not to the failures of nature and farmers, but to systems of distribution. Almost 16 million children in the United States now live with hunger, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that is not because the vast, agriculturally rich United States cannot produce enough to feed all of us. We are a country whose distribution system is itself a kind of violence. Climate change is not suddenly bringing about an era of equitable distribution. I suspect people will be revolting in the coming future against what they revolted against in the past, the injustices of the system. They should revolt, and we should be glad they did, if not so glad that they need to. One of the events prompting the French Revolution was the failure of the 1788 wheat crop, which made bread prices skyrocket and the poor go hungry. The insurance against such events is often thought to be more authoritarianism and more threats against the poor. But that's only an attempt to keep a lid on what's boiling over. The other way to go is to turn down the heat. The same week during which I received that ill-thought-of press release about climate and violence, ExxonMobil Corporation issued a policy report. It makes for boring reading unless you make the dry language of business into pictures of the consequences of those acts undertaken for profit. Exxon says, quote, "We are confident that none of our hydrocarbon reserves are now or will become stranded. We believe producing these assets is essential to meeting growing energy demand worldwide." Stranded assets, that mean carbon assets, that means coal, oil, and gas still underground, would become worthless if we decided they could not be extracted and burned in the near future. And because scientists say that we need to leave most of the world's known carbon reserves in the ground if we're to go for the milder rather than the more extreme versions of climate change. Under the milder version, countless more people and species and places will survive. In the best case scenario, we damage the Earth less. We are currently wrangling about how much to devastate the Earth. In every arena, we need to look at industrial scale and systemic violence, not just the hands-on violence of the less powerful. When it comes to climate change, this is particularly true. Exxon has decided to bet that we can't make the corporation keep its reserves in the ground, and the company is reassuring its investors that it will continue to profit off the rapid, violent, and intentional destruction of the earth. That's a tired phrase, the destruction of the earth, but translated into the face of a starving child in a barren field, and then multiply that by millions. Or just picture the tiny scallops, oysters, Arctic sea snails that can't form shells in acidifying oceans right now, or another superstorm tearing apart another city. Climate change is global violence against places and species as well as against human beings. Once we call it by name, we can start having a real conversation about our priorities and values, because the revolt against brutality begins with a revolt against the language that hides that brutality, end quote. And finally, this from Common Dreams, it's Wynne Stevenson, quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle." Frederick Douglass, 1857. Quote, "Screw the Earth. Earth Day. No, I mean it. Screw Earth Day. Not the first one, 44 years ago, the one with sepia-hued nostalgia, but everything the day has since come to be, the darkest, cruelest, most brutally self-satirizing spectacle of the year. Screw it. Let it end here. End the dishonesty, the deception. Stop lying to yourselves and to your children. Stop pretending that the crisis can be solved, that the planet can be saved, that business more or less as usual. What progressives and environmentalists have been doing for 40-odd years and more is morally and intellectually tenable. Let go of the pretense that environmentalism, as we know it, virtuous green consumerism, affluent low-carbon localism, head-in-the-sand conservatism, feel-good greenwashed capitalism comes anywhere near the radical response our situation requires. So yeah, I've had it with Earth Day and the culture of progressive green denial it represents. But why Frederick Douglass? Why bring him into all this? And who am I to invoke him, a man who was born a slave and who freed himself from slavery, who knew something about struggle, whose words were among the most radical ever spoken on American soil? Who the hell am I? I've never suffered racial or any other kind of oppression. I've never had to fight for any fundamental rights. I'm not even a radical, really. Nor am I an environmentalist, and never have been. All I want is a livable world and the possibility of social justice. So who am I to quote Frederick Douglass? You want extreme? Business as usual is extreme. Just as climate scientists, the building is burning. The innocents, the poor, the oppressed, the children, your own children, are inside the burning building. And the American petrostate is spraying fuel, not water, on the flames. That's more than extreme, it's homicidal. It's psychopathic. It's insane. Let me tell you who I am. I'm a human being. I'm the father of two young children, a 14-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter, who face a deeply uncertain future on this planet. I'm a husband, a son, a brother, and a citizen. And yes, I'm a journalist. And I'm an activist. And I like more and more of us who are fighting for climate justice. I'm engaged in a struggle for the fate of humanity and for life on Earth. Not a polite debate around the dinner table, nor in a classroom, or the editorial meeting, or an Earth Day picnic. I'm talking about a struggle for justice on a global scale. A struggle for human dignity and human rights for my fellow human beings, beginning with the poorest and most vulnerable far and near. a struggle for my own children's future, but not only my children, but all children everywhere. A life and death struggle for the survival of all that I love, because that is what the climate fight and the fight for climate justice is. That's what it is. Because I'm sorry, this is not a test. This is really happening. The Arctic and the glaciers are melting. The great forests are dying and burning. The oceans are rising and acidifying. The storms, the floods, the droughts, and the heat waves are intensifying. The breadbaskets are parched and drying. And all of it faster and sooner than scientists predicted. The window in which to act is closing before our eyes. Any discussion of the situation must begin by acknowledging the science and the sheer lateness of the hour, that the chance for a smooth, gradual transition has passed, that without radical change, the kind of livable and just future we all want is simply inconceivable. The international community has, of course, committed to keeping the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.63 Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial average, the level, we're told, at which catastrophic warming can still be avoided. We've already raised it by 1 degree, with still more baked in within the coming decades. But there's good reason to believe that 2 degrees will lead to catastrophic consequences. And of course, what catastrophic depends on is where you live and how poor you are, and more often than not, the color of your skin. If you're one of the billions of people who live in the poorest and most vulnerable places from Bangladesh to Louisiana, even 1 degree increase can mean catastrophe. But the world's climate scientists and leading energy experts are telling us that unless the major economies drastically and immediately change course, leaving all but a small fraction of fossil fuel reserves in the ground over the next 40 years, we are headed for a temperature rise of 4 to 5 degrees, even 6 degrees Celsius, in this century. The World Bank has warned that 4 degrees, quote, must be avoided, but we're not avoiding it. Global emissions are still rising each year. We're plunging headlong towards the worst-case scenarios, critical global food and water shortages, rapid sea level rise, social unrest, and beyond. The question is not whether we're going to stop global warming or solve the climate crisis. It is whether humanity will act quickly and decisively enough to save civilization itself in any form we're saving. Whether any kind of stable, humane, and just future, any kind of just society, is still possible. We know that if the governments of the world actually wanted to address the situation in a serious way, they could. Indeed, a select few, such as Germany, have begun to do so. It could be done at relatively low cost, and yet the fossil fuel industry and those who do its bidding have been engaged in successful decades-long efforts to sow confusion, doubt, and opposition, and to obstruct any serious policies that might slow the warming or their profits and buy time. As I've said elsewhere, let's be clear about what this means. At this late date, given what we know and have known for decades, to willfully obstruct any serious response to global warming is to knowingly allow entire countries and cultures to disappear. It is to rob the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet of their land, their homes, their livelihoods, even their lives, and their children's lives, and their children's children's lives, all for money and political power. These are crimes. They are crimes against the earth, and they're crimes against humanity. What? Are you shocked? The same industry, the same people committing these crimes, while we subsidize them for their trouble, have been getting away with murder long time, and yet it continues. What is the proper response to this? How should I respond? Remain calm, we're told. No scare tactics, no hysteria, please. Cooler heads will prevail. Enjoy the Earth Day festivities. Screw it. The cooler heads have not prevailed. It's been a quarter century since the alarm was sounded. The cooler heads have failed. We want sweet, cool-headed reason? No. How about this? Masses of people, most of them young, a generation with little or nothing to lose, physically, nonviolently disrupting the fossil fuel industry and the institutions that support it and abet it. getting in the way of business as usual, forcing the issue, finally acting as though we accept what the science is telling us. But that's a little extreme, isn't it? Really? You want extreme? Business as usual? That's extreme. Just ask a climate scientist. The building is burning. The innocents, the poor, the oppressed, the children, your own children are inside. And the American petrol state? Spraying it with fuel, not water. That's what I said earlier. That, to me, is insane. That's extreme. Coming to grips with the climate crisis is hard. A friend of mine says it's like walking around with a knife in your chest. I couldn't agree more. So I ask again, in the face of this situation, how does one respond? Many of us, rather than retreat into various forms of denial or fatalism, have reached the conclusion that something more than environmentalism is called for, that a new kind of movement is the only option, that the only thing at this late hour offering any chance of averting an unthinkable future and of getting through the crisis that already is upon us, the kind of radical social and political movement that has altered the course of history in the past, a movement far less like contemporary environmentalism and far more like radical human rights and social justice and liberation struggles of the 19th and 20th centuries. Does that sound hopelessly naive to you? Trust me, I get it. I know. I know how it sounds. And yet here I am, because I also know that abolishing slavery sounded hopeless, naive in 1857 when Frederick Douglass spoke of struggle. What I'm talking about is not a fight to solve the climate crisis. That's not possible anymore. But neither is it simply a fight for human survival, because there are oppressive and dystopian forms of survival, not to mention narcissistic ones, that aren't worth fighting for. What I'm talking about is both a fight for the survival and a fight for justice, for even the possibility of justice. It's a fight that transcends environmentalism. It requires something of us beyond the usual politics and proposals, the usual pieties. It requires the kind of commitment you and I must have for radical movements, the kind of struggles from abolition to women's labor and civil rights that have made possible a way of thinking that everything previous was unimaginable. Because our global crisis, not merely environmental, but moral and spiritual, is fundamental. It strikes to the root of who we are. It's a radical situation requiring a radical response, not merely radical in the sense of ideology, but a kind of radical necessity. It requires us to find out who we really are, and nonviolently, in the steps of Gandhi and King and many others, to act, in some cases, lay down everything. And it requires us to be honest with each other and with ourselves about the situation we faced. We'll never have a moment radical enough or humane enough until we are. That is, until Earth Day is buried and a day of reckoning begins. End quote from Wynn Stevenson, former editor of The Atlantic and The Boston Globe, and published also in The Nation. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Now we're going to go to our talkback segment, where you have a chance to call in and share your thoughts and opinions and questions on issues that are relevant. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also, let me mention that this Sunday and next Sunday at 9 a.m. in Center Park at 5th Avenue 90th Street, the Natural Living Running and Walking Club will be meeting. And that's the last 2 weeks that you can come and get started, either training to get yourself in ideal shape with us every Sunday, or training for the marathon, walking it, running it, jogging it. So you can do either. You don't have to train for the marathon, but a lot of people will. And it's free. And you'll be with about, I think we had 16 coaches last week. So it was fun. Look forward to seeing you this Sunday, 9 o'clock, 5th Avenue, 90th Street. I'm concerned about violence. I'm concerned about violence in people's ideologies. Go to a local station board meeting if you want to see emotional violence, inaction, inertia. It's a system that cripples the entire governing structure, so nothing gets done. It prevents good people from sharing messages and keeps bad people in place. This is true throughout the United States in boardrooms and panels and meetings and homes. I don't think we really understand the nature of violence, but we should. It's a long and coveted place in U.S. history. Vigilante groups, including slave patrols and gunslingers and Pinkerton and Baldwin felt detectives, gangs of strike breakers, gun thugs, company militia, the White Citizens Council, the Knights of the White Camellia, the Ku Klux Klan, which boasted more than 3 million members between 1915 and 1944 and took over the governance of some states, formed and shaped America. Heavily armed mercenary paramilitaries, armed militias such as the Oath Keepers and the anti-immigration extremist groups, and along with omnipotent and militarized police forces, are parts of a seamless continuation of the American culture and tradition of vigilantism. And roaming the landscape along with these vigilante groups are lone gunmen who kill for money or power or at the command of their personal demons. Now, as Chris Hedges sees this, vigilante groups in America, they don't trade violence for violence. They murder anyone who defies the structures of capitalism, even if the victims are unarmed. The vigilantes, often working with the approval and sometimes with the collusion of state law enforcement agencies, are rarely held accountable. But maybe I'm mistaken. At the height of Operation COINTELPRO, when J. Edgar Hoover was running his own police state, when he tried to have Martin Luther King commit suicide by secretly tape recording King's liaison with another woman, and them threatening to leak this to his wife and destroy his reputation, was he ever held accountable? He broke federal laws. Were any of the FBI agents held accountable? Were any of them held accountable who infiltrated the Black Panthers or other groups and fomented terrorist acts? No. In fact, when was the last time you heard of a national security agency, a CIA operative, of any one of the 16 federal agencies who've committed massive crimes against humanity? When have any one of them ever stepped foot in court to be held accountable by the same laws that you and I would be judged? They don't. Interesting, someone asked me last night, watch Bill O'Reilly, he's on a rip about why we have to stay a nation of laws, and these militia members who went to, you know, the side of the guy in Las Vegas, Bundy, were found guilty, and they're guilty of not paying. He was guilty of not paying grazing fees. Okay, so he was guilty. All right. Here's the issue: if you're going to say that he and everyone who supported him were nothing more than an irresponsible lawbreakers, and that we must obey the law, it is the law that we must stand by at all times. Fair enough. We accept it. But then you also don't believe in welfare, and we accept that. We shouldn't have welfare, starting with corporations. So let's take away all the welfare of Wall Street. Oh, then that meant that virtually every major financial institution would have collapsed. Good thing, it should have. I advocated for it. But people who were either corporately and economically ignorant said, oh no, that America will collapse. I said, no, it won't, because Wall Street is not tied to the actual financial structure of the average American. They're playing in a casino, and we could close a casino and it doesn't change anyone else, because they're not loaning money. They're not building factories. They're not employing people gainfully in the United States. These are the people on Wall Street that make money off money. They have over $460 trillion in derivative positions and credit default swaps. But when they committed crimes, including money laundering, That's against law. No one went to jail. Not a single person. When they laundered $800 billion, one bank, they were found guilty. They paid a $900 million fine, and nobody went to jail. So by us supporting their welfare, and then the coal industry, the nuclear industry, not a single nuclear plant could have been built or sustained in the United States without massive subsidies. And they're dangerous. And they lied. But that's a different set of laws. So not one single major corporate leader who has been repeatedly responsible for death and destruction, including the head of the company making Vioxx that killed 60,000 Americans, not one's held personally accountable. But there's a law about killing people, even if you kill them without intent, homicide. But no one is charged with a crime. And when you got us into Vietnam, nobody was charged with a crime. When you lied about the need to go into Iraq, nobody was held with a crime against humanity. When you start illegal wars, no one's held accountable. When you say that we must all pay our taxes, and then the wealthy corporations, wealthy individuals find ways of not paying them, that's all right. I'm Gary Noll. Those are my thoughts. Thank you for listening. Let's go to our calls. I have some calls up right now. Let's say hello to Stephen from Las Vegas. Hi, Stephen.
I just wanted to ask you about kale and the thyroid.
First of all, as long as you're not eating a lot of kale, it's fine. It's not going to impact your thyroid. Unless you have a severe thyroid or condition, it's fine. Greens are fine, providing they are not in concentrated amounts. If you have a bad thyroid, I wouldn't be juicing kale. All right? Let's say hello to Rashid from New Jersey. Hi, Rashid.
Gary, thanks for taking my call. I want to ask you a question. In the black community, I see that they're selling a lot of Kangen alkaline water. They're buying these expensive machines and making wild claims. Can I get your opinion on this?
There's nothing in the claims that I could support. If they just wanted to sell water as water, that's fine. But until such time, and I've looked at the science, until such time that I can find the studies done by objective scientists to show that it's anything other than water, then it's just, in my opinion, a wild claim, and I would not buy the machine for that reason.
All right? Okay, thank you so much, Gary.
All the best to you. And David from New Rochelle. Hi, David.
Some people think that we ought, for an Armageddon, we ought to have a place in Vermont or Ohio or someplace where there's water and we can grow crops and all that. But meanwhile, surrounding us are millions of people with starving children, and each of them has a house full of guns, rifles. What then?
The only place you can do if it gets to Armageddon is go and hide behind either Wayne Newton or Donald Trump. Their hair will protect you from all those people's guns. They can't get a bullet through it.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Luann.
I tell you what.
They're eating too much kale. That's the problem.
I don't know. Well, Gary, I'm getting still a lot of wonderful feedback about your lecture from last week. And I had a woman email me who has been suffering from severe depression and anxiety for many years. And she had just finished watching your DVD on overcoming anxiety and depression. And 2 days later, she listened in. She was one of the, I think, the last people that got on to watch the PRN feed. And she emailed me, and she said, it was like a light bulb went off. I suddenly realized the entire duality of the whole psychiatric field and how I had adapted to their expectations of me as someone who was labeled as clinically depressed with anxiety. And she said, it was in that moment that I realized that I didn't have to do this anymore. And she sounded so upbeat in the email, and she said, now I'm going to work with an orthomolecular psychiatrist. I've decided to wean myself off my psychotropic drugs, and she says, I have a whole new lease on life, and she emailed me to thank you for that. It's wonderful.
That goes to the whole idea that the moment you accept the legitimacy of duality, then you're automatically removing yourself by degrees from what should be a normal, happy state of mind, with emotional contentment, you're in control of your own power. You can use your power as you choose. And instead, when you accept a diagnosis from them of depression, you now have taken a step away from your own empower, from the light of that. And then when they say you must take these drugs, you take another step, that it's not through self-determination, through spiritual rebalancing, but rather through a pharmaceutical adjustment that you're going to find this. But of course, no one ever says it made the difference. I took the antidepressant, I took Prozac, Zoloft, and now I know who I am. My life is content. It doesn't work that way. All you find is that people are going deeper into a place, but frequently they're able to go deep into that place of despair without acting out. And so one day they've been on the drug so long and their sense of self is so diminished that they don't even recognize the truth anymore. And that's why making incremental steps back doesn't work. A quantum step back does, when you say, I've accepted an artificial experience to supersede an authentic experience, an adjusted manifest reality for an authentic reality. So in going back to the truth of who we are is how we all start our journey of authenticity. And there's where your authentic healing can come. Glad to see that you made that change. And just last night, my program was on spirituality.
A perfect capstone to the lecture.
Yeah, yeah, the two. If people didn't hear it, they can download it. Thank you, Luann. Let's go over and say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann. Today, we get a political reality check from the front lines, as it were.
Which front lines?
The national front lines of the U.S. of A.
Okay, good. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead right now.